Donald Byrd on trumpet and Pepper Adams on baritone sax, and a quintet all together with kudos. Herbie Hancock on piano. This, by the way, was his recording debut. Lehman Jackson on bass and Jimmy Cobb on drums. It's from their 1961 album, Out of This World. Kuros, you might want to know, was a popular jazz joint in Milwaukee. And this was where Herbie Hancock got his big break with this group, playing the piano. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. And a couple of notes up front, just to remind you, we are still not yet up with our phones, and it's going to be a couple of days more before they are finally back with us and up and running. So we begin the week. We still are not able to talk to each other, but that is coming soon. I ask your indulgence and your patience, and it's something that, of course, nobody asks for, but these things happen, and so we are working as fast as possible to get the repairs done so that we can be up and talking with each other. Well, a couple of topics I want to talk about today. And the first is that I want to talk about this wonderful budget of yours. I'm giving it to you. I'm not claiming it at all. On Friday evening, a delirious President Trump and a coterie of Republican leaders delivered tidings of great joy. Trump announced that it was his Christmas gift, after all. And what was this great gift that they delivered unto the nation? There is, at last, a budget. And all that's needed now is a final vote in the houses, both houses of Congress, to put the new budget into effect. That process begins today. And with Republicans, with Republicans controlling all branches of government, the presidency, the House, and the Senate, it is unlikely that the Democrats will succeed in making significant changes to the $1.5 trillion budget. And even at $1.5 trillion, it is said to be an undercount. It's going to be much higher than that, closer to $2 trillion. Well, I want to talk about this because, first of all, you know, a lot of people are waxing philosophic, and news media, they're acting as if they know what's in the budget. And basically, they're reporting what other people tell them is in the budget. And it's very important to note what's not in the budget. But, you know, with almost 1,100 pages, I doubt they had the time to really carefully go through this document and to study it. And to ask people who know how to read budgets, not just what's in it, that's not a very difficult thing to report, what's in the budget. But when you look at a budget, what you're looking for, you're looking for many things. First, just like a speech, you try to understand the context of the budget in the same way you try to understand what I call the environment of a speech. It tells you a lot. The budget provides a glimpse, not the entire thing, but just a glimpse of where the president's head is at and where the ruling party is at. What is it that they're trying to accomplish here? with this budget. And a budget is not something the way we understand our budget, our version of what we mean by a budget. It means that it's a spending plan. And a spending plan that accommodates all these major needs, but at the same time, it has to be balanced. All budgets should be balanced. So the minute they say that this is a $1.5 trillion budget, what they mean is this is $1.5 trillion added to the current debt that we have. So don't just think it's just $1.5 trillion. And therefore, the logic will be, if the president envisions doing all these things that would cost $1.5 trillion, if the idea still is that he must put together a balanced budget, it means that there will be severe cuts somewhere. That's the first thing you have to understand about a budget. This is their dream list of the things that they want. And therefore, in order to balance the budget, they will now have, because they're now adding $1.5 trillion to the deficit we already have. So it means that they will have to make severe cuts. Now, about that $1.5 trillion, let's understand what it would more than likely represent. I haven't read the budget. As I said, they just squirreled this thing away, and in the dark hours of Friday, I don't know who has had the time to read almost 1,100 pages worth of budget bill, but I know that I haven't. Including last minute changes that, if you recall, were handwritten and nobody could figure out what was meant by those scrawls. This is the second time Trump has done this, and he learned this from other presidents. When they want to do something really, really crazy, they present it on a Friday when most everybody's gone home, and they spring it on an unsuspecting public. This is the second time Trump has done this. All right, so we have to understand this is the president's first official budget. Notice I'm not talking numbers yet. I'm talking about how you understand a budget. This is the president's first budget. And he had already touted, before he officially took office, that he will make America great again. But as you can see, the people who dominate this president's cabinet and people in a position to persuade him, his donors, he has to repay donors. He's got bills to pay, political bills to pay. And so we can expect that a huge chunk of this budget will be payment. When I say payment, I mean giving a select group of people exactly what they want. And what they want is money and more money and more money. So the budget, you can expect, if you're reading a budget right, you look for those items in the budget that relate to other than immediate needs. You'll expect to find a lot of pork in a budget like this, the first budget of the new president. He's got a lot of payback to make. And of course, coming out of the world of the of real estate, which I call the oldest swamp in America, you would expect, if I were to decipher this budget, I would look for all the real estate linked items and the policies, quote unquote, that would be developed to cover these tracks. So a budget tells us a lot if we keep in mind some of the important factors to consider. We should always keep them in mind. So a new president with a new mantra, he's been beaten up pretty badly. His own political base appears to be eroding. They're not happy with the way things have been going for this past year. They are working class people, and they are very angry about the even greater divide between rich and poor in this country. They're sick of it. Just the same, Trump now has a whole bunch of people he has to please. Huge donors. He has to please himself and his whole family. They're all about money. So some policies will have to go. And he still has to pretend to the people that he is really sincerely interested in making all boats rise. By being inventive and being bold and so forth. So leading up to this budget, we heard a lot of propaganda about, it is going to be the best budget ever, the greatest gift, speaking, patronizing. And of course, it makes no sense when the president says, I'm giving you the best Christmas gift ever. Who are you, Santa Claus? So we have to look at a budget, not only with the figures staring us in the face, but we also have to keep in mind all these different behind-the-scenes actions that are going on. He's got a lot of people to please. He's got the military to please. He's got these industrial sectors to please. He's got the wealthy to please. He's got all of these special interests to please. And he will please them in the budget. It will mean displeasing of a huge swath of America, but that is not important to him. Is important that the people he needs to please will be pleased. And of course, that includes himself and his family, who are all in business and they all love money. And the only thing they like more than money is more money. He has the power now as president to enact changes to tax laws and so forth. He has the power to, because he, I mean, the Republicans own the House, they own the Senate. Which brings me, of course, to the Democrats. The Democrats are always in a situation of saying no. That's the extent of their contribution to the discussion about a budget. No. We oppose the budget. Okay, what is your budget? What is your plan? We've been asking this of the Democrats for how long now? What is your plan? Irrespective of the president's plan, what is the Democrats' plan? We have no idea, other than no. We don't want this and we don't want that. But the fact is, they're not necessarily relevant anymore in this discussion. It would be nice if they would cooperate as far as Trump is concerned. But the Republicans know that they hold all the cards. The Democrats can't mount a credible fight against them. The Republicans own all the cards. So the Democrats' big fight, which they will try to persuade us is what they're doing, the big fight, it's really token resistance. And even so, those items that they're fighting for, the dominant items that they will be fighting for, will be to please their donors and their special interests before the people. They'll tell the people, we're here fighting for you, but not really. An election is coming up, midterm elections, and we have another election right after that. So they have a lot of distance to make up for, because they've fallen far behind and they've fallen down. The Democrats are out of money, which means they need a lot more money now, an infusion of money. They want to build on this recent victory in Alabama, and it takes money to build on that. And with all of this demand for money, they have to give people in positions of power over them whatever it is they ask for, to try their best to deliver. It doesn't matter about the people too much. They'll argue and fuss and fight and wave that flag in front of us that they're fighting for the people. But they too are fighting to deliver to their special interests. Now, no budget is going to itemize this. They're not going to tell you this is what is in this budget or in any budget, a large percentage of which is pork. So when people are told, well, you know, it's going to be good for you because your taxes will go down, the corporate taxes are going down, this will invigorate the economy, it will spark jobs, more people will go into business, and we will have a bustling economy. Guess what? Nobody is in a position to guarantee any of that. That's just what they want to happen, or that's what they're saying will happen. There's no guarantee of anything with this budget or any other budget. So people should keep that in mind. Forget what you're being sold. You're being sold a bill of goods. And it has to be that way because Trump is in deep trouble. The Republicans are in deep trouble, and their standard bearer is in even worse trouble, because he's an inveterate liar, and a whole bunch of people around him also are inveterate liars. They have to tell a story and do everything in their power to make the people believe everything they say will come true. It's the season where sugar plums are dancing in people's heads. So the whole budget, there is nothing in this budget, and there will be nothing in this budget that is guaranteed, except the cuts. Now those are guaranteed. Brace yourselves, because here's what they're going to do. Even so, they're not going to cut severely right off the bat. They will have to keep people calm, because these elections are looming and you can't turn people off. So they will gradually sail through a period of time where we let down our suspicions, because things will go as they say, sort of, or they'll make it look like things are going to go as they say. And then right after these elections, boom, the hammer comes down. So they'll give you a little hope. They'll give you a little something to tide people over and keep them quiet for about a year or two. And then there will be a budget adjustment when the boom is lowered. So that's how you read a budget, a political budget. You don't even look at the numbers first. In the first instance, what you have to do is kind of talk to yourself, talk your logic through to yourself. A budget is one of the greatest instruments of propaganda. One of the greatest political weapons that can be used, either to endear the people or to really punish the people. But here we already are seeing the evidence that Trump had been meaning, he actually said it before this budget was formulated, that the people who are suffering the most in this country are the wealthy. They are bearing an undue tax burden, and they have to be taken care of. Never mind the widening gap between rich and poor and all these policy discussions that we've been having for a long time. That goes out the window. This budget coming at this point with the new president fighting for political survival, he is going to do everything possible to give up to the people who own him what they desire, and himself too, because he's one of them. In fact, it's no exaggeration to say that the budget is constructed primarily with the needs of Trump's and his pals in mind. Give them immediate relief. Give them immediate reward. And that's what constitutes a budget, if you're looking at it right. So at some point, people will go through very, very carefully. We've been getting these scattershot interpretations of the budget, but the interpretations are merely literal. They're literal. And they accept something that nobody in their right mind should accept, which is that the budget is a sane budget. The budget is real. This can be done. You're proposing to add 1.5, and that's conservative. It will be $2 trillion before you know it. By the time the Democrats start looking at it, it will be up to $2 trillion added to the deficit now. But these politicians don't care. Because by the time we really get a walloping, they'll be out of office with all the goodies that they desired. This is the budget that is to tide them over beyond the election, the next election. It is very sad that the Democrats are not doing what they're supposed to do here. And what seems to be most important about this budget, as with most budgets, is the absolute lack of transparency. This budget process is an undemocratic process. The people, we're not involved. We're just the people that the budget happens to. We are not invited to the conversation. When these budgets are formulated, the people have no input whatsoever. So it's an exceedingly undemocratic process. And if there's one thing that the Democrats can do, is to begin the process of reversing that and scuttling this process. It's not good. It's never worked. And it boils down to members of Congress deciding to have a party with taxpayers' money. And under the so-called color of law, they make decisions that have very little to do, really, with the benefits of the people. Very little to do with it. And they are there, they're making deals for themselves, for their cronies, for their donors, for special interests. But we don't get to see any of that. All of this is happening behind closed doors. And I'm saying that it is time that the budget process be entirely open. This is not for a club to decide to, behind closed doors, how trillions of dollars are going to be spent, i.e., put on the backs of people to pay off. Who do you think has to pay off that debt? It is going to come due. And we will be expected to make additional sacrifices to pay off a debt we didn't ask for. And in some cases, is totally unnecessary. We have no idea what this budget process is. It is designed like that. The Democrats and the Republicans agree that's the way it ought to be. And we should be in the streets saying, never again. And not, in fact, we should be saying, not now and never again. This is insane. You're giving tax credits to people who don't deserve it or don't need it. But you have a yawning gap between rich and poor. You have serious poverty in this country. They don't care about that. So we'll see what comes out. I'm searching around for a very adept analyst of budgets. And again, I don't read from the point of view that what's on paper is real. No. I'm interested in what this document says about what they have done to distort our total reality. And to what degree we already have been compromised by these corrupt people. I don't have to ask whether it's corrupt. I don't have to ask whether this is a corrupt budget. You know it. And people should be in the streets about this, protesting the fact that this is not, you talk about democracy. Is this democracy? Where all the people, working people, poor people, working poor people, all that we are expected to do is to just go with the program because we have no power to change it. So this week, supposedly, they're going to be, coming together, the Democrats and the Republicans, to put the final note on this budget. They're going to, negotiate. What are you negotiating? Budget is corrupt. How about that? Could you negotiate that? Could you uncorrupt the budget? Decorrupt the budget? You can't, and you won't, because this is where the Democrats have so much in common with the Republicans. They are servants of a growing oligarchy. I'll take a pause here for a minute, and then I'll come back and talk about refugees in our own land right after this. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, I'm Eutrice Lead. Governor Ricardo Rosselló of Puerto Rico conceding that official counts of deaths due to Hurricane Maria are extremely inaccurate today ordered a review of every death attributed to the Category 4 storm that devastated, as you know, devastated the island 3 months ago. Independent media did not find the numbers to be credible and undertook their own investigations and found that more than 1,000 people died in addition to the 64 officially listed. And they know at least 1,000 people died, other than 64. How many more other than the 1,000, they don't quite know. So now, since that 64 number has stood for so long, since the hurricane, 3 months now, this is the official number they're going by. Now the governor of Puerto Rico has had to step back on that. And he has had to agree with the popular outrage over this that he backed away from that 64 people who died, and is now demanding that there will be a recount, if you will, to see who of the first, what is the total number? Would it be different from the number that the news media organizations that undertook independent probes of their own? And it was early in the game. This is interesting because given the devastation that the island suffered, in the early stages, if you remember, they had said it was in the 40s and then it went to the 50s. And finally, they just said 64 and that's it. But people on the island said, no, it's more than that. And then the news organizations found out that people who were cremated, whose remains were cremated, were not counted. There are people who are missing and have not been found. We don't know whether, what happened to them. It's not known. But there was a great interest in containing this number, which, again, President Trump basically touted the benefit, in a sense, that the storm was merciful to grant, which was that it did not kill that many people. Yes, there's a great deal of damage. In fact, an estimated $93 billion in damage. But he was talking about how grateful that we should all be that the storm didn't kill that many people. So this calls into question the operations of FEMA, because 3 months since the storm, and the island is still in disarray. And basic things like drinking water that is clean, not available, readily available. Roads still remain impassable. The houses, of course, still remain in total disrepair for the most part. And we have seen no further engagement and no further commitment to engage in helping Puerto Rico come back to normal life. But an interesting thing happened this past week. We learned that Refugees International, this is a group that looks out for the rights of refugees all over the world. And they came to Puerto Rico and did an extensive survey of the island and were very distressed at what they saw. And what they saw was that a whole island was basically converted to refugee status based on how they were living. So Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans have been dealing with this for 3 months, and now an international body that reports on refugees all over the world said they saw no difference between refugees in so-called developing countries and the status of the people in Puerto Rico. They are living the lives of refugees in their own land. These are Americans, after all. Have you ever heard of people being considered refugees and living in refugee-like conditions in the United States, fellow Americans, where so many people are now leaving Puerto Rico every single day? They cannot make a go of it. The infrastructure is shot. Their jobs are gone. Their homes are gone. Their communities are gone. And everything one would need, even the basics of clean water to drink and food, their crops are gone. And this exodus now from Puerto Rico to the United States mainland, it's like they're refugees. It's not a situation where people believe, well, it's a temporary fix. We leave and then things will be fixed up while we're gone and we can go back probably within a month or two. It's not that kind of a party. But it should tear at the heartstrings that an international body that basically sees to the needs of refugees, all of their needs, in terms of
policy and monitoring conditions has pronounced that the people of Puerto Rico, abandoned by the government, and now in a state, a frantic state of survival, are in fact refugees. What a shame. How terrible is that? Now that should make a president so embarrassed that in this country, this world power, you have an internationally recognized body saying that it regards 3.4 million or 3.1 million people in Puerto Rico, the people of Puerto Rico, the entire island of Puerto Rico, granting it, in a way, refugee status. And what do we associate with refugees? Lack of food, lack of proper shelter, lack of the basics. That's what they say, the Refugees International, that's what they say Puerto Rico is. It's a land of refugees now. And there isn't a thought by this administration that it ought to really be concerned about its fellow citizens. But then you have a trenchantly racist government that does not see it this way. In time, maybe 20, 30 years, it will bounce back. And you know, they're accustomed to being poor. They're accustomed to doing without. They're accustomed to dealing with not having the best of anything. So this is not extraordinary suffering. This is not an extraordinary circumstance. Yes, the storm did some damage, but this empty-headed president thinks that that has to do with just the buildings and not the people. And yet, supposedly, the United States has all of these resources that immediately should come into play. Now, I know for a fact that is not going to be the attitude with these fires and people losing their houses because of the wildfires out in California. These are real people now. The news bulletin this morning said that the fires, there's great concern. Why? Because the fires are headed toward the homes of the wealthy. So they're concerned about that. Contain the fires before they hit the wealthy and their homes. But everybody else is just toast. Are we seeing any kind of backlash about that? No. In Congress, are we seeing a vigorous engagement with this president and his administration, his rotten administration, his heartless administration? This is not a reality show. These are real people's lives at stake. And it should be ever a disgrace that a group of people who are accustomed to seeing and dealing with refugee issues all over the world. They found them right here at home. These are fellow citizens. In fact, for a while there, I'm pretty sure that Donald Trump wasn't sure that Puerto Rico is a territory of the United States. He certainly didn't think that of the U.S. Virgin Islands. He was saying things like, oh, I met with the president of the U.S. Virgin Islands. First of all, the U.S. Virgin Islands doesn't have a president. It has a prime minister. But he is president of the U.S. Virgin Islands as well. That's how dense this president is. So out of tune. So out of it. But it really is a very serious situation, and citizens have to come forward now and demand that the government behave itself as if it understands what this is. It's not the United States and a couple of islands over there. The United States government is responsible, ultimately, for seeing to its citizens, wherever they are. And we know that this was not something anybody asked for, in the same way that nobody asked for these roaring fires that have now set a record for the numbers of acres engulfed in flames in California. Nobody asked for that to happen. But even though nobody asked for it to happen, the government is very clear that now that the fires are encroaching on wealthy neighborhoods, now it becomes really, really something that they have to intercede and make sure that it doesn't happen, that these millionaire homes don't go up in flames. What a sick and pathetic situation this is. And we should be very angry about it. And we should be demanding from all the people who are very quiet now, all the progressives in leadership positions, all of the people who are organizing movements and whatnot, organize a movement about this. To his credit, Bernie Sanders did take a tour and came back and insisted that it become a top priority item. I wish he would continue to press for the resources to help this island heal and come back. We know that members of the Congressional Black Caucus and the Latino Caucus have been very, very concerned about it. But they have no friends. They're not getting the response from this administration that they ought to get in behalf of the people. And these are, again, these are Americans. It is very sad indeed. But we can't just sit by and say it's sad. And we just can't sit by and let this undemocratic process of the budget occur without us making a serious attempt to turn things around. I feel so powerless because we have a runaway government and a greedy government. And you may recall months ago, even before the storm, I talked about how people were assembling in San Juan, federal court in San Juan, and then next in federal court in New York City. Interested parties were busy deciding who was going to get what in Puerto Rico as it deals with its so-called deficit. And I was outraged that there weren't any Puerto Ricans in the courtroom or anybody representing the people in the courtroom fighting alongside or fighting in behalf of fellow citizens who are being trounced, thrown under the bus. Their land is about to be taken from them. Well, I will leave things there today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.